You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the SmartCast Micro Learning Podcast Series on metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Kia Jones, and I'm the medical director at Med Learning Group. This podcast is the first of three podcasts in the series titled Improving the Overall Safety and Quality of Care for Your Patients with Metastatic Hormone-Sensitive Prostate Cancer. How does your approach compare with the experts? This series will be hosted by Dr. Andrew Armstrong, a medical oncologist and professor of medicine at Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, North Carolina. And with that, let's go ahead and get started.
Thank you, Kia. I'm Andy Armstrong. I'm a medical oncologist and professor of medicine here at Duke, and I'm honored to lead this three-part series podcast in the month of Movember. Really great to be with you to raise awareness of advanced prostate cancer. And this is a great month for fundraising for a great cause. Dr. Labriola is joining me today as an assistant professor of medicine. Both of us are starting clean shaven today, and we'll be getting growing mustaches and setting fitness goals and fundraising goals throughout the month, mostly for prostate cancer. This podcast is going to be on improving the quality of care for men with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. We're going to be talking through some of the rapidly changing guidelines and evidence-based recommendations, as well as some of the areas of unmet need and controversies in the field as you take this home to your real-world practice. So Matt is a medical oncologist and assistant professor here at Duke who regularly sees, patients with advanced prostate cancer. Maybe you could talk us through just for a few minutes about how you talk to your patients who present with metastatic disease or develop relapsed metastatic disease and get referred to you.
Thanks, Andy, and thanks for having me. Excited to be here and talking with a good friend and colleague. And it's about a really important topic, a really common topic. And this is probably, the most common thing that I'm seeing in clinic these days is new diagnoses of metastatic disease or recurrence presenting as metastatic disease. And, it's a really emotional time for patients, right? So, first and foremost, helping them to understand what the diagnosis means, kind of what the prognosis is, many people, once they hear they have stage four or metastatic disease, are really scared and worried. So helping them understand what they're up against. And it's a lot to cover here, right? You have to explain the diagnosis. You have to talk through kind of all of the modalities of treatment that we now have available to us to treat our patients with the most efficacy. So talking through androgen deprivation therapy, our androgen targeted agents, as well as chemotherapy, genomic profiling, bone health, cardiovascular health. It's a lot to cover in an initial visit. So really need to take the time to cover all our bases here. When I'm meeting someone after I get to know them a little bit and help them feel comfortable in clinic, I usually start off by talking about androgen deprivation therapy kind of as the backbone of therapy. And once they understand that, it helps me kind of paint the picture of why we escalate and how we escalate.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It can be overwhelming. Fortunately, our new patient visits, we get about an hour, but our return visits are shorter, 20 and 30 minutes. But sometimes I find it's important, when you're starting systemic therapy to ease some patients into it and then have continued conversations, such as, layering in the discussions around genomic, genetic testing, familial risk, things like that later, but not necessarily a long time later, maybe in the second or third visit, as the importance of germline alterations can be very important both for clinical trials, but also familial risk, particularly BRCA mutations and other alterations. Maybe Matt, talk us through a little bit about how you make a decision around doublet versus triplet therapy. There's a wealth of acronyms now, STAMPEDE, CHARTED, LATITUDE, TITAN, ARCHES, and ENZAMET, testing doublets. And then very recently, ARASENS and PEACE 1, you know, we don't have to go through all of the data, but, you know, NCCN guidelines, AUA, EAU, ESMO, you know, all have, you know, guidelines both nationally, internationally that now have very strong level one evidence for treatment intensification. We're not seeing that necessarily in the real world, but in our practice, I would say, you know, 90% of patients are probably getting treatment intensification. Maybe walk us through a little bit about, you know, some of the nuances of which patients, you know, you consider doublet and which patients you consider triplet for.
Yeah, this is a really important issue today. And, you know, I think one of the major take homes from this podcast, right? There was a study done looking at Medicare data showing that about 40 to 50% of patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive disease are being treated with ADT alone. And then there was a study out of the VA system showing about 60% of patients being treated with ADT alone. And, you know, we can just do much better with the data that we have, both with doublet and now with triplet showing efficacy. So I think it's probably helpful just kind of like to walk through the timeline of what studies have come out and how they've improved care of our patients. And then we can talk a little bit about decision making, who to intensify and who gets triplet. So, you know, obviously CHARTED and STAMPEDE back in 2014, 2015 gave us the first efficacy of docetaxel in this space. Preferentially for patients with high volume disease. And then, as was mentioned, LATITUDE STAMPEDE in 2017, which introduced abiraterone plus prednisone, along with ADT beating ADT alone. You know, abiraterone is an androgen signaling inhibitor, right, that blocks 17-alpha hydroxylase. And basically, the way I explain it to patients is, your androgen deprivation therapy is shutting down your testosterone from your testicles, but we do need to also shut down the testosterone production from your adrenal gland. And we can talk a little bit about, you know, the side effect profile of each of these drugs and how we make decisions. In 2018, we had the efficacy of radiation to the primary, which Dr. Armstrong will cover in the next podcast with Dr. Fecto. And then in 2019, we had ARCHES and ENZAMET showing the benefit of enzalutamide plus ADT over ADT alone. TITAN introduced apalutamide in 2019. And then most recently in 2021, 2022 is when we had the exciting data behind triplet therapy with PEACE 1 showing the benefit of abiraterone plus docetaxel and ARASENS showing the benefit of docetaxel plus darolutamide. And both of these, you know, and what's important to note about these studies is that the comparison was to a doublet with docetaxel and not a doublet with one of our androgen targeted therapies. But what we found was that there was a particularly large benefit in those with high volume disease. High volume disease by CHARTED criteria, meaning they had visceral metastasis or four or more bone mets with at least one outside of the pelvis and spinal column. We do now have a study, comparing. We had data just come out from ESMO also showing that, you know, in the low volume patients, there actually is continued benefit as well. But I think that, you know, the biggest question is, you know, who should get triplet and who should get doublet? And I usually start by looking at their initial imaging and just determining if they're high volume or low volume. And then, of course, looking at the patient themselves and assessing their performance status, kind of what their comorbidities are, if I think that they'd be able to handle getting chemotherapy, because we want to do things that are benefiting patients and not causing harm. But, you know, I think one of the questions, and maybe I can pitch this back to you, Andy, is, you know, this, all these studies were done in the pre-PSMA PET era, right? This is with conventional imaging, with CTs and bone scans. You know, how do you typically, you know, use PSMA PET scans in how you decide who's high versus low volume?
Yeah, that's a great description of these studies, Matt. And, You know, I think what impressed me about the treatment intensification studies is just how much more survival benefit we're seeing with treatment intensification when you use it early versus these exact same drugs when reserved in the castration-resistant setting, for example, docetaxel and high-volume de novo disease, and provided a nearly year-and-a-half survival advantage as compared to the same drug provided a 2 to 3 month survival advantage in TAX-327, for example. And then with enzalutamide, apalutamide, abiraterone, you know, hazard ratios for survival of, you know, around 0.6, which is amazing. You know, extra years of life, not extra months of life. And so, you know, the advent of the PSMA PET scan, which you brought up, is really changing our stage migration, our knowledge about who has metastatic disease and patients that would have otherwise been labeled non-metastatic. There's really no consensus about how to incorporate PSMA PET right now into these kind of treatment decisions. All of the trials that you just quoted used conventional CT bone scan MRI and did not include PET imaging. And, you know, I would say that, you know, there is some recent data like from our ARCHES study in the oligometastatic population where there is a survival and progression-free survival advantage to treatment intensification, even in patients down to a single metastasis. And with the EMBARK study, which is labeled as a non-metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer study, there is a significant metastasis-free and nearly overall survival advantage, still not mature for survival, but presented and published now in the New England Journal. And most of those patients would have been PSMA PET positive in those PSA recurrent high-risk, you know, fast doubling time patients. And so it does suggest that, you know, we should be offering treatment intensification to any patient with metastatic disease, regardless of how they're labeled. You know, I'm not ready to offer docetaxel to patients who are high volume by PET imaging. And I think, you know, the jury's still out on that question. You know, certainly the de novo low volume patients, there's a suggestion of a survival benefit with triplet therapy. We just don't have the data around the PET imaging. And certainly I discuss that with patients. If they're high volume by conventional imaging, you know, those are the patients, if they're chemo fit, that I'm having that discussion with. But nowadays I'm seeing a lot of patients get PSMA PET right up front. And, you know, that's really challenging, you know, how we define disease volume. A lot of these, you know, tracers can pick up microscopic disease that would not otherwise be appreciated, but might explain some of the heterogeneity and outcomes in a lot of these studies. So in the Advanced Prostate Cancer Consensus Conference, this was an area of no consensus. I would just put it out there. And I think this boils down to individual informed decision making. You know, if you have a patient that really does have high volume disease, it's certainly not wrong to offer the most life prolonging therapies you have. But I would also caution that, you know, we don't have data about withholding radiation to the primary. You know, we have data that it is life prolonging in conventional low volume patients. And if you have a high volume patient by PET, but they're low volume by imaging, I would not withhold a life prolonging therapy. So I'm all for treatment intensification here. I'm not for, you know, not using the correct evidence to withhold therapies that might help patients live longer. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I totally agree. It's becoming more and more challenging because, as you mentioned, so many patients are now getting only PSMA PET, right? And once you see, like, okay, they have, you know, 4 or more bone mets, they've got maybe a you know, several nodes, and it's like, oh, technically they're now high volume, but we probably wouldn't have seen these small, tiny little rib mets on a CT and bone scan. So what do you do? And I agree, right? We know that radiation to the primary has a survival benefit. You know, I think the hardest thing and maybe the most important thing is who's the patient, right? Are we going to be maximally aggressive, or are we going to be kind of cautious around you know, comorbidities and frailty? So for, you know, a young patient who has, you know, this borderline high versus low volume on PSMA PET scan, I'm surely going to be referring them to my rad-on colleagues to radiate the primary and talk to them about the spectrum of, you know, adding an androgen-targeted therapy and even chemotherapy for them if they're young and healthy and want to be maximally aggressive. I think, you know, if I were to summarize the general approach, you know, once I figure out volume, if they are high volume and I think that they can tolerate therapy based off of performance status, I do typically give combination of, ADT with docetaxel and darolutamide in the high volume metastatic hormone sensitive setting. And then if they are low volume or, are very, very frail, have significant neuropathy, you know, significant cytopenias that I worry about giving docetaxel to, I treat with ADT plus one of our androgen targeted therapies, either enzalutamide, apalutamide, or abiraterone. And I choose those based off of toxicity profile and the patient. So for patients who I typically prefer abiraterone are, maybe older patients over the age of 75 or so because of the lower incidence of cognitive dysfunction and falls and fatigue compared to enzalutamide. However, you do need to take a steroid with abiraterone to prevent mineral corticoid excess. So for those with uncontrolled diabetes, uncontrolled hypertension, fluid retention, or heart failure, I do worry a little bit about abiraterone. But then with enzalutamide, I typically use those in the younger, maybe more fit patients who I worry less about falls and cognitive impairment, but do avoid it in patients who have high seizure risk, either from a previous seizure, a previous large stroke, or hemorrhage. And you do just need to warn these patients that diarrhea is quite frequent. Apalutamide is also another great option based on Titan. I would say anecdotally, it seems to be slightly better tolerated in terms of fatigue and fall risk and cognitive dysfunction. But we do have to worry about rash, which occurs in about 30% of men on that drug. So that's my general approach. And then as was mentioned, if low volume or kind of borderline on PSMA PET, I make sure that they see my radon colleagues to radiate. Andy, I guess I'll kick back to you. I think one, if there's anything you want to add on that point, but also curious how you approach ADT and which drug to offer, whether that be, an antagonist or agonist or oral or injection.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. That's a perfect summary. You know, I would say that all of the potent AR inhibitors are what we call similarly effective. The hazard ratios compared to ADT alone are very much identical. So there's not a wrong choice. The only wrong choice might be to not give a potent AR inhibitor. You know, the only patients I might consider ADT alone would be in those patients who are not tolerating therapy, who have a very short life expectancy, significant comorbidity. But in my practice, that's less than 10% of patients. And so I think treatment intensification is now really the standard of care. And the choice between the AR inhibitors is really based on drug-drug interactions, with ENZA and APA having more drug interactions to look out for, particularly anticoagulants and lipid-lowering agents, abiraterone with the mineralocorticoid excess and steroid use, some increased cardiovascular risk like atrial fibrillation. But these are all, winners. And, sometimes it boils down simply to the cost to the patient. In terms of the form of ADT, the initial form of ADT might matter. If you have a patient with symptomatic disease, spinal cord compression, I favor a GnRH antagonist. There's relugolix as an oral agent or degarelix as an injectable, and that achieves, really rapid castration within 3 days and avoids that testosterone flare with the GnRH agonist. But I tend to rapidly switch patients to a much more convenient GnRH agonist schedule. I don't think, it's very hard on patients to afford the copays long-term of the oral agents, and the monthly injections with degarelix is really, in a combination setting, never really been shown to have any advantages over GnRH agonists. Even monotherapy, the PRONOUNCE study didn't really show any differences in cardiovascular risk between agonist versus antagonist. There are some ongoing studies like the REPLACE CV testing the cardiovascular safety of relugolix versus leuprolide, and certainly we're enrolling on that study and testing whether there is a cardiovascular health benefit of relugolix alone or in combination with a potent AR inhibitor. I would say the jury's still out. We have equipoise on that question. But my general standard of care is to look for patient convenience. And the longer acting every 3, 4, or 6 month injectables are much more convenient and avoid some of the expensive co-pays for patients. And, optimal cardiovascular risk management for these patients means encouraging exercise, heart healthy diets, attention to blood pressure and home blood pressure monitoring. All these drugs can cause hypertension, and managing that with the primary care doctor or cardiologist with abiraterone, minimizing the risk of ischemic events or atrial fibrillation, hypokalemia. For bone health, for ENSA and APA particularly, we see, accelerated fragility and osteoporosis, and screening for bone density scans regularly, and proactive use, if you have a patient developing osteopenia, is the use of drugs like denosumab or bisphosphonates. Really exercise is a major component to all of this for long-term survivorship. A lot of our patients are now amazingly living 5 to 7+ years, even in remission, before they develop relapse on these potent AR inhibitors. So really important survivorship aspects. Let me turn a question back to you, Matt, and talk to you about some of the gray areas that you would like to see answered in this disease space before we finish. I know there's some ongoing trials testing precision therapies like PARP inhibitors, AKT inhibitors. The STAMPEDE-2 trial is now testing metastasis-directed radiotherapy. What other things would you like to see, get tested for in research studies that we don't know about?
Yeah, that's a great question, Andy. And, I think there's a lot of exciting things happening on the horizon right now. I think, everyone's wondering about, how are PARP inhibitors going to play out in the metastatic hormone sensitive space, given all the positive data we have in the, metastatic castrate resistant prostate cancer space. I think you mentioned Amplitude, right? Looking at niraparib plus abiraterone prednisone in those with HRR gene altered disease, and then Talipro-3, looking at talazoparib plus enzalutamide in this space, which, are exciting studies. We always want, as we found, right, with Arisins and with PEACE-1, right, as we start to combine efficacious therapies and in the upfront setting, we're able to, get more patients these beneficial drugs before it's, quote unquote, too late, right? What we worry about is having a therapy that could have really, really helped a patient live longer and live better and not being able to get to it due to progression clinical decline. So it would be really exciting to see if a PARP inhibitor would show benefit in the hormone sensitive space. We're also at Duke looking at Capitello for those with P10 loss, and it would be exciting to see if that AKT inhibitor is beneficial in combination with abiraterone, and all highlighting the importance of sending genomic profiling on our patients early to make sure we understand the biology of their disease and see if there are any potential targets that we have for them. Particularly in clinical trials. I think the other big question is where lutetium is going to fit in this landscape. Of course, we have Vision and now PSMA-4 showing benefit of lutetium PSMA in the castrate-resistant setting. But is that going to play out in the first line in hormone-sensitive disease? Hopefully PSMA addition gives us some information. What are you excited about, Andy?
I agree with all those things. I think one big area is, can we actually cure metastatic patients? We're seeing patients achieve complete remission. We're seeing the convergence of metastasis-directed therapy, delaying systemic therapy or even combining with systemic therapy. And some of my patients are, wondering, can they stop therapy? If they've completed radiation to all visible sites on PSMA PET or conventional imaging, they're on systemic therapy, they've achieved the goal of complete remission, what's the data for stopping? I think the EMBARK study suggests that, we could consider intermittent systemic therapy even with these potent AR antagonists. And so I think STAMPEDE-2 and, PSMA-directed radiotherapy and converging ideas around best systemic therapy plus the application of cured intent therapy might allow some patients in the future to stop therapy. So that's also part of my hope.
Yeah, I agree. EMBARK's really exciting from Neil Shore, you know, comparing enzalutamide plus ADT versus ADT alone versus enzalutamide alone in patients with biochemical recurrence who had, you know, no evidence of disease on conventional imaging, again, not PSMA PET. And if you can stop therapy at that 37-week mark, if their PSA is near undetectable at less than 0.2. And that approach did show a substantial, you know, MFS benefit with the doublet of enzalutamide plus ADT. And I think it does kind of give us some, you know, some guidance that perhaps in some lower volume patients who, you know, have an undetectable PSA, particularly if they've had radiotherapy done to, you know, all sites of disease, perhaps we can give them a really long treatment-free interval. And I think that's a really exciting aspect of the field.
Well, thank you, Matt. This was a great podcast. And please stay tuned for parts 2 and 3, which will cover some other aspects around the role of multidisciplinary care and radiation, the issues around disparities and both by race and as well as by practice patterns. We're going to cover all of these in a three-part series. The treatment of men with this condition, metastatic hormone-sensitive disease, has really dramatically improved in recent years. I hope you appreciate the time. We appreciate the time you took to listen, and please send us any feedback. Thank you very much.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This podcast is brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to also thank our grant supporter, Janssen, who provided an educational grant for this activity.